You're listening to Unceded Airwaves by the Indigenous Collective at CITR 101.9 FM. Unceded Airwaves is broadcasting from the traditional, ancestral, unceded lands of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Heard David Morin with Come Home from the album Every Color for this week's show intro. This is Unceded Airwaves, broadcasting every week from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. My name is Lisa Gerbov. I come from the Tsimshian Nation. My mother is from Lough Quilliams, and I grew up in Prince Rupert. And as a student here at UBC, I acknowledge that I am an uninvited guest on the Musqueam territory while I study on the UBC campus. And we have a very busy show today, so maybe we'll do a round of intros for the Indigenous Collective members. Carly, we'll start off with you.
Hi, I'm Carly Baker. I'm Cree Métis and Icelandic. My family is from Treaty 1 territory, the Red River Settlement, but I was born and raised on the traditional unceded ancestral territories of the Stalo people. And I am a Masters of Fine Arts creative writing student here at UBC.
Okay, and my name is Nikita Day. I'm Taltan, originally from the Taltan Nation, Telegraph Creek, but I grew up on Wet'suwet'en territory in Smithers, and I'm a third-year student here, GRSJ major.
Another northern girl.
Yes.
we want to thank you, our listeners, for tuning into Season 2, Episode 17. I can't believe we're already at Episode 17. I say this every week, but episode 17 seems like a feat. This week, we are dedicating a few segments to some very important topics. One segment is going to be on the Women's Memorial March, which is happening tomorrow at noon. That's going to start at Main and Hastings. We also have a segment that raises awareness about the Highway of Tears that I produced as part of a class project. If either of these topics are sensitive issues for you, we want to welcome you to change your dial, and you can tune back into CITR at noon after the show. Later on in the show, we have a segment by Josh Gabert-Doyon on the Ricochet Reporting Fund as well.
We are the Indigenous Radio Collective. We put together this show every week to discuss Indigenous issues, current events, and entertainment. We are a collective of Indigenous and non-Indigenous students who use this weekly airtime for our own self-representation.
And our goal with the show is to center the voices of Indigenous people and create narratives that empower our stories. Self-representation in media that is something that isn't often afforded to Indigenous people. So we're using the opportunity that we have with Unceded Airwaves to challenge some of those representations and offer the space for self-representation as well.
Yes, yeah, so basically this show gives us an opportunity to define who we are as Indigenous people instead of relying on inaccurate, often stereotypical representations in broadcast media, because Indigenous cultures, as we all know, are just so diverse and so nuanced.
It can be difficult to find positive Indigenous role models in popular media, so this show is offering an opportunity to highlight some influential Indigenous people, such as David Morin, who you heard in the intro, who Nikita and I are both huge fans of.
Big fan of his.
And so this is our opportunity to really highlight some influential people.
Yeah, and if you're listening to this and you can relate to the goals of the show, or you're wondering how you can get more involved, please reach out. You can always find us on our social media. We have Facebook, Twitter. So please, if something you've heard here strikes a chord, then we want to hear from you.
Everyone is welcome. And there's no experience necessary. Our weekly meeting is Wednesday at 4 p.m. here at CITR in the lower level of the Nest. If you want to get involved but don't want to be on air, there are plenty of other ways you can participate in this collective. This week we're playing all Indigenous music, thanks to Laurie Sinclair Emerson for helping us to find some tunes.
Yeah, and so you can follow Unceded Airwaves on Facebook and Twitter. And if you have an Indigenous artist that you think we should know about, send us a tweet using the hashtag Unceded Music, or send us a Facebook message at Unceded Airwaves, and we will do our best to get it on the air. And if we play a song you send us, we will give you a shout out on the show.
And we're always looking to hear from our listeners about what you're up to. So if you have any Indigenous artists that you're into right now, or if you have an event that you're attending and promoting, you can send us a message on Facebook or on Twitter using the hashtag Unseated Events. And we'll share our Unseated Events listing a little bit later on in the show. We have some shout outs to those First Nations who are occupying their territories, the Leelu Island Warriors, the Standing Rock Lakota Sioux Tribe, the Maddie Lee from the Gitxsan Nation, Unistoten Camp, which is the Wet'suwet'en peoples, and the Tsilcoteen Nation, who is still in an ongoing 30-year legal battle with Taseko Mines and their bid to revive a large copper and gold mine in their territory that they are currently fighting. Going on 30 years is a long time, so we commend you for that. That long battle. To start off the show today, though, we wanted to talk about an event that happened over the weekend that, Carly, you were a part of.
Yeah, thanks, Lisa. I read a couple of poems at an event last week called Warm Disruptions. I've got Wendy Simon and Kevin Kokoska here with me. They're both profs at Native Education College. Thanks for coming in on a holiday to talk with me, guys.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, I read a couple of poems at this event. What I noticed right away was that it was a performer-led event. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I really like that you say performer-led event, because that really was the intention, to almost to not have an intention or open it up to the performers and allow it just to become what it's going to become, instead of getting out in front of it and leading it.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, I read a couple of poems. A lot of monologues and that's improv. The improv was really
right,
so. It's a really high energy evening, and started us off with a little. Do you want to tell us about? We were talking about this earlier. I found the opening really, really mind blowing and quite ingenious. You want to tell me about that?
Sure. Yeah. So I am of Polish ancestry, and I'm kind of in this active and ongoing engagement with what it means to be a guest on this unceded territory, and I feel like perhaps I should have been engaging in this process far earlier, and I'm looking at, so actually the event itself is a way of doing that. I've been an artist, or what I would call an artist, for a number of years, and I'm looking to kind of broaden the scope and engage with artists in different communities. So when it came down to this event and doing a territorial acknowledgement at the beginning, and also wanting to introduce the event and making it clear that this is an artist-led event, like you said, I collaborated with a couple of students of mine at NEC, and we did kind of, I don't know, what would you, it was kind of improv-y, what would you have?
Yeah, it was just, oh my gosh, it was such a great way to kick off the evening. So Kevin, I'll just tell you guys about it. Kevin was sitting in the audience, and the students called him up on stage. And I don't know if you, my impression was that you had no idea what was about to happen, which really heightened the sort of the intensity of the moment. And Kevin sat down, and these two students manipulated Kevin's arms and basically did this, hi, my name is Kevin, I'm a white dude, and I'm doing a territorial acknowledgement. And now I'm patting myself on the back. And I just found that it was so, like, what a way to start the evening with this really bold statement about something that is really... The territorial acknowledgement, this is big right now. And
right.
Why do we do them? Why do we give them? How do we engage with the land that we're on? And so I thought it was bold and sassy.
Cool. I like bold and sassy is what we're going for. I was a little bit aware, but we were kind of playing with this idea of what would it be like to flip the power dynamics here, where, they know me in a particular way, and they maybe know white hosts of events in a particular way, but we're looking to change this. So how might we flip that without me having to totally minimize myself, but still engaging with them and making it a more even power dynamic? And that's something that Wendy's, we're constantly in dialogue with my, I am with my colleague Wendy, about what does that look like to take a different role, but not to minimize.
Yeah, we talked earlier about providing space and entry points for performers to elevate voices, but to get to, again, to allow the performers to take the lead in that process. Is that something that you feel like we were working on Friday and Wednesday? There were actually two shows, Wednesday and Friday.
What I admired about the process was that it was rather deconstructed. And with that, the lower the expectation was about what should or could necessarily happen. And then it was left to the art to make that connection with the audience and the people, but still being mindful of our relationship to the land and that we have these opportunities here to connect and to merge with other artists.
And I think one of the artists that I'd like to highlight is Danielle Thomas, who is one of our Indigenous Collective members. And we are so thrilled to have Danielle part of our team because Danielle is a phenomenal writer and actually wrote the article for us in Discorder magazine this month in the February issue. And so we're thrilled to have Danielle part of the Indigenous Collective. But also Danielle was performing at this event, sharing a few pieces.
Yeah, she sang two songs that were sort of like a, it felt like to me anyways, like spoken word music combination kind of. And
like a lyrical spoken word almost.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it blew my mind. I mean, I was thinking about running these lyrics through my head for days afterwards. It was really intense stuff, gritty and honest. And I hope we'll see more from Danielle in the future.
I am so heartbroken that I missed this performance. Like, it was the day after I messaged on Facebook being like, did this already happen? Did I miss this? Thinking it was this coming Friday. But that just means that there will have to be more events.
Yeah. Do you guys have more events in the works? Or is there some way that folks could follow along and find out? Besides unseated events, we'll definitely plug you guys in the future. But
right. Yeah. So we are very excited about the response to last week. And we are very interested in moving forward and hearing more from the voices that were shared this week and from new voices. A cool thing that happened on both the nights, I think, which and this happened with Wendy on the first night, which I mean, maybe you did secretly have something prepared. But yeah, as an audience member, she felt inspired to come up on stage and share. So it's really nice to open those avenues as well for people who maybe are experimenting or just feeling something in the moment and wanting to get up and share their voice. So down the road, we are very open to making new community collaborations. So if folks are listening and have a space and are open to sharing it or collaborating with us in some way, we'd be happy to speak with you about that. Yeah, so we just want to kind of keep this positive energy and momentum going.
That's great. Yeah, so I'm hearing performance-led, collaborative, Indigenous and non-Indigenous, with the idea of growing. You could also contact us here at Unceded Airways if you had a space that you'd like to share, or you can contact Kevin. Kevin and Wendy, thank you so much again for coming in and talking to me.
Thank you.
Niawa.
Thanks so much. And we got to keep the show going because we have a few different events that we want to touch on in addition to this this grassroots kind of fundraiser that you guys were involved with last Friday. Still so glad that it went well, but really sad that I missed it. But coming up, we wanted to talk about the Women's Memorial March, which is something that's been on our minds here at Unceded Airwaves for the past I think I've been thinking about this segment since I first started here at Unceded Airwaves. And so I'm really thankful that Haley Lewis, who is an Indigenous Collective member from the Mohawk Nation, was able to go out and do an interview with Myrna Kramer about the Women's Memorial March. And so this is a segment that Haley has contributed for Unceded Airwaves. And so we're going to play it for you right now.
My name is Haley Lewis, and this is a special segment for Unceded Airwaves on CITR 101.9 FM.
To assimilation, to colonization, and we have to rise above that, everyone.
The beating of drums and the Women's Warrior Song mark the start of the Downtown East Side annual Women's Memorial March. Every February 14th since 1991, people have been gathering at the corner of Main and Hastings to commemorate those missing and murdered.
Well, we've been marching for 27 years, and the unfortunate thing about the march is it will always happen because women are being killed in the downtown East Side.
Myrna Cranmer has been in and around the downtown East Side since 1969. She has been both organizer and participant in the march, as well as longtime advocate for the community's women.
There's a lot of women that, you know, that work in the community, that live in the community, that walk the streets and make sure that the women are safe. They look out for the welfare of women. And it's hard. It's absolutely hard because there's so many organizations in the downtown East Side that, bless their little hearts, come from a good place, I believe. But they open at 8:30 and close at 4:30, you know, leaving the women on their own.
Because Myrna operates within the confines of such a small, close-knit community, she truly understands what's needed, and bringing that level of awareness to the broader community is one of the main goals of the march.
It's a day that someone chose because it was a day of love. Mm. These women are loved, they're missed. And we're not forgetting them, you know, and I say we as women that put the march together.
Most of us carry lists on our person, and so does Myrna. But unlike our lists of little importance, Myrna carries a list of names.
These are all the women that have died since I started working down there.
The list is over 5 pages long. Names of sisters, mothers, daughters, and friends. As different as these women are, there's one thing they all have in common.
These women shouldn't be dying. These women shouldn't be dying, and they are.
February 14th is really important to the organizers, participants, family, and friends.
It brings the community together. It brings the women that are still down there a chance to gather to eat at the end of the march. And yeah, it brings the families. The families who are heartbroken, grief-stricken, alone, and have no idea how their female relative died, mm-hmm. you know, and...
Although the march has been happening for almost 3 decades, this year is different. In a world where marches and movements are commonplace, it is important to keep the purpose of the march intact.
We have guardians at the beginning of a march, and if the signs do show up, we just ask them to politely take the sign down. Mm-hmm. This isn't about that guy in the United States. You know, mm-hmm. it isn't about that. Today is about missing and murdered women. And it's about the Aboriginal women because there's just so many of them, you know. And there are other ethnicities too. But you know, it, yeah.
6 months after the announcement into the inquiry for missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, it seems not much has changed, and there is little difference for marchers.
It's that depraved apathy. Nobody cares. You know, so 53 or is it $54 million has been spent on this inquiry. Another, I could be wrong, $19 million is being set aside for the families, and that is definitely needed. Mm-hmm. But you know what? Give me a few million dollars and I can open up someplace in the downtown East Side where that we can keep our women safe.
Regardless of circumstances, the march continues to take place. And like anything, there are certain protocols.
The elders in the front with their medicines, mm-hmm. as they call them, and then the drummers behind them and everybody else behind them. We ask that no one have any signs. We ask that you stay behind the elders and the singers. We have a woman that wrote the Women's Warrior song. that is always behind. And there's usually a big circle around me and Hastings, which is really, really symbolic. You know, there's dancers, there's a blanket that women have sewn together, and the panels are surrounded circle. And then march begins, and we march north toward the mountains.
One of the most important things about the march is the representation of the roses.
Our elder women, Rita and Annie, they say a prayer and put a yellow rose if they're missing, and a red rose if they're murdered. Very significant, and we really try and get that information out because we want you to come in march, but we actually would like you to know why we're stopping so many times.
Myrna, like many women who have spent decades in the Downtown East Side, marches for a specific reason.
The last couple of women that have died, it really, really hit me. So I march for the women that live down there, that have died down there, and all the women that are headed here, because they're still coming, and they're still dying. You know, I march for them.
Whatever your reason for marching, coming out and supporting the Downtown East Side Annual Women's March is a meaningful way to spend your February 14th.
Okay, so you heard a segment by Haley Lewis on the Women's Memorial March. So thank you to Haley for contributing this segment with Myrna Kramer. So the 27th annual February 14th Women's Memorial March is actually happening tomorrow. And so it'll be starting at noon at Main and Hastings. And we'll be posting the event info on our Unseated Airwaves Facebook and Twitter page. So you are listening to Unceded Airwaves on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. And next up, we have a song by Samantha Crane called Outside the Pale. So let's give that a listen.
And property when we run this damn machine. tell you about my bed. Become a CITR member and make some new friends.
Members get discounts in Kitsilano and around UBC at The Book Warehouse, Stormcrow Ale House, The Australian Boot Company, Fresh's Best Salsa and Company, Banyan Books and Sound, Tapestry Music Limited, Rufus Guitar Shop, Dentry's Irish Grill, the UBC Bookstore, On the French Hair Design, and the Bike Kitchen.
What would we do without our friends?
Ocean, border, sub, urban, dispersal, determinacy, mulatto, mestizo, Métis, Cabra, Eurasian, Creole, colored, colored, split. Those who have no history are doomed.
An excerpt from The Reinventing Wheel, spoken by author, Vancouver poet, Wade Compton. Celebrate Black History Month with CITR 101.9 FM as we host content exploring Black history in Vancouver and beyond. Tune in this February and check out CITR.ca for regular updates on the scheduling of our Black History Month programming.
All right, you heard the song by Samantha Crane, Outside the Pale. That song we will post in the link to the podcast on our website at CITR.ca/unceded-airwaves. You can find all of our podcasts there, and we'll also post that on our Facebook and Twitter pages. My name is Lisa Gerboff, and this is Unceded Airwaves, broadcasting from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Next up, I wanted to air a piece that I created last semester that was part of a class. I was taking the FNIS 401F Indigenous New Media and Digital Storytelling course with David Gertner. And in this class, we were given the task to create a digital storytelling assignment. And so myself, along with my group members, Clara Salter and Olivia Santa Croce, we created this podcast that was written and produced on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. And it's an original piece. It's about a story that I have chosen to share, but it's combined with a remix of different quotes from different Indigenous authors and activists. And so what we did was we started off to create a poem, and how it turned out was more of a creative nonfiction narrative. But I'll play the segment for you and maybe chat a bit about it after it airs. So this is about 13 minutes long, and this segment is called A Story About a Dream.
This story takes place a long time ago, or maybe right now.
It sounds older than song.
I want to hear the hushed quiet just before the hum of the quake the animals hear.
It is earth moving, the northern sky, animals, and human soul.
She has a different intelligence than the rest of us.
She sways, bends, crouches, dances.
I think it's more authentic if you speak Rez, Auntie. It's more decolonized.
Her hand moves as if weaving, pulling, and scratching these sounds out of her body.
An ending, a beginning. An ending, a beginning.
You're the listener, and your job is to listen.
This is a story about a dream.
In the beginning, there was nothing. Just the water.
And dreams are very powerful.
Where did the water come from?
You are rebellion, resistance, reimagination.
I'm from the coastal nation of the Tsimshian people. We are the people of the Skeena River.
Where did the water come from?
Your dug-up roads, 27-day standoffs, the foil of industry prospectors.
The Tsimshian territory is located at the mouth of the Skeena River, east of Haida Gwaii on the mainland, south of the Nisga territory, and at the westernmost end of Highway 16, the Highway of Tears.
Get up, start walking.
the land.
She can read the tracks of all the animals.
I had this dream when I was away.
From tracks, she can tell anything.
Living in Victoria last winter.
Have you let a lake or a snowbank sketch silent letters on your back?
I was dreaming I was back in the Tsimshian territory, in Terrace, BC, in the summertime.
Where did the water come from? You are not a vessel for white settler shame.
I was in town in Terrace on this beautiful summer day.
Where did the water come from?
Courage has a ripple effect.
Where did the skateboard come from? I think. I have this skateboard, and I'm skateboarding around town. Terrace is on Highway 16. The highway goes right through town, from one end to the other. I don't skateboard in real life. I haven't skateboarded since I was a teenager, back before I had a license. But in dreams, you can do anything. So I'm skateboarding in my dream of all things. It's a beautiful day. Blue skies, warm air, the wind is blowing lightly. It's a beautiful day to be outside skateboarding. I'm out skateboarding around town, and I think, I'm going to skateboard out to Kitsum Kalem. By myself. Kitsum Kalem is an Indian reservation about 3 kilometers out of town on Highway 16, headed west towards Prince Rupert. I'm feeling energized from the weather and the exercise, so I set out on the highway to Kitsum Kalem. It takes me a while to get out there, but the weather is nice and I don't mind. The cars pass me by, but I don't mind. I keep skateboarding. I'm going out to Kitsum Kalem to the reservation, and I make it out to the Kitsum Kalem Tempo gas bar. It feels good to get all the way out there. I think, this is such a beautiful day. I'm going to skateboard all the way to Prince Rupert. Prince Rupert is about 150 kilometers west of Terrace. My dad says it's the most beautiful drive you'll ever find. This is going to take me all day, so I think I better get started. I want to visit my family. My mom lives in Prince Rupert, and so does my dad, and my younger brother too. I know they appreciate it when I come home, especially my mom. I look out towards Prince Rupert, Highway 16 at my feet. The best time to visit the Skeena is just before the start of spring, when the oolakins start to run. You can see nearly every kind of species come to the Skeena to feed after a long winter. They've come for the oily little fish that visit the mouth of the Skeena. I'm looking west. On my right, the mountains and thick forest are deep green. The contrast is vivid. I imagine my favorite mountain across the Skeena, the one with the giant crack down the middle. Or the other one that looks like a glacier shaped it during the Ice Age. It looks like two hands together in the shape of a bowl. On my left, the Skeena River is turquoise blue. It looks so peaceful. I remember that I also really love the scenery here during waterfall season, during the spring runoff. The places where the Kayaks, Ixchamsiks, and Kitsum Kalem rivers meet the Skeena are some of my favorites. The road is smooth where the cars drive, but there's rocks on the shoulder. I remember the pictographs at Tai, where Laguerre's portrait looks out over this territory. You can see it from Highway 16. I'm ready. I set out. I'm about to move toward the highway on my skateboard when someone appears right in front of me.
Pain. There is a sound for pain. Love. There is a sound for love. Joy. There is a sound for everything. A breath. And I am there.
It's a man. He looks a bit strange. He has a pale face with black hair and is wearing all black clothes. How strange for someone to be wearing all black on a bright sunny day. I can see his face. He's right in front of me. But I can't really see his body. His body is shifting and moving around from side to side. He's not staying very still, except for his face. Besides his face, everything about him is shifting. I can see his wide eyes. They're looking right into my eyes. And his nose is straight and pointed, like a beak. He reminds me of a bird, a raven. He's wearing all black and has a beak of a nose.
I'm not the only one.
We're standing fairly close to each other. He's standing between me and the open highway.
I'm not the only one.
The shapeshifter looks at me with his wide eyes and asks, "Where are you going?"
She wasn't always lost in a world not her own, or as they think, lost in a world of her own making.
I tell him, "It's a beautiful day.
I'm not the only one.
I'm going to skateboard to Prince Rupert. I want to see my family."
I'm not the only one.
The shapeshifter doesn't move an inch. He looks at me with that wide-eye look and says, "Don't get lost." I stand and look at him, and he says it again with that wide-eye look. "Don't get lost," he says. My heart sinks. I know what he's talking about. It's not safe for girls to take the highway alone.
If you knew how proud they are.
It's especially not safe for Native girls.
That you made it to the age of 16. Life is short. 21. The world is at least 25.
Many Indigenous women and girls go missing on the Highway of Tears.
30. 50% terrible. 36. This place could be beautiful.
For many.
Age 10.
There is no choice.
Right? You could make this place beautiful.
No safe transportation from isolated reservations into town to get groceries, see the doctor, visit family, pick up the kids from school. "Don't get lost," the shapeshifter says. I stop. I turn around.
The rotation of the earth around the sun mimics us.
And I skateboard back into town, back to Terrace.
She'll be okay until the sun takes her back in.
I wake up. My heart is heavy. And I know this is a warning for Northern girls. When I was a kid, my mom would time how long it took for me to walk from my friend's house to home. Three doors down the street. Now when I travel Highway 16, I let my mom know before I leave, and I call her right when I get into town. She still times me. She knows how long it should take. And she does the same when she's traveling on the Highway of Tears. Two grown adults. Two grown women. Two Tsimshian women. Does everyone do this? Or is this how we've had to adapt to living in a society where violence against Indigenous women is all too common? A society that has allowed 1,200 Indigenous women go missing or be murdered. Ever since this dream, I haven't traveled the Highway of Tears alone.
This is a collaboration piece by UBC students Clara Salter, Olivia Santa Croce, and Lisa Gerbaugh. We acknowledge that this podcast was written and produced on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
The story about the shapeshifter is a creative nonfiction that was written, produced, and dreamt by Lisa Gerbaugh, a member of the Tsimshian Nation. Lisa grew up in her territory in the city of Prince Rupert, the territory she still calls home.
The remix of samples and quotes, voiced by Clara and Olivia, were intentionally selected and rearranged to interact with one another, to create a new meaning within the context of the narrative, while channeling the authors and artists that inspired this work.
We sampled the work of Holamia Sparrow and Rosanna Deerchild. We featured the work of Caitlin Boulding, Brené Brown, Tanya Tagak's cover of a Kurt Cobain song, Linda Hogan, Thomas King, Erica Violet Lee, Leanne Betasamasak Simpson, Maggie Smith, and Lee Miracle. You can find the full credits to the work cited by following the link to the blog in the description of this podcast.
Violence against Indigenous women and girls is an ongoing systemic issue that many women face. To get involved, you can raise awareness of this issue by participating in the annual Women's Memorial March on February 14th, the Moosehide Campaign, or by organizing a grassroots demonstration in your own community. You can find links to resources in the description of this podcast. Learn more about these issues to challenge the injustices Indigenous women and girls face. Carry this knowledge with you and continue to resist systems of colonial violence.
So that was a segment that I created for the class FNIS 401F, Indigenous New Media and Digital Storytelling. That was called Story About a Dream. I'll post a link to that podcast on our Unceded Airwaves Facebook and Twitter pages for you to find afterwards. And Carly, you heard this in class the other day. What did you think of it?
Yeah, that was great. Lisa came in and screened it at FNIS 220. I don't know the exact designation, but it's Indigenous Representation in Literature, Film. We're just talking about Indigenous representation in general. Since I do some writing myself, what I really noticed was the nice, clean narrative. And I actually closed my eyes while it was screening so that it was easy. It was just really easy to connect with the emotional content as well as just the imagery and the narrative content. So I thought it was really effective.
Awesome. And kind of what we started off was trying to make this poem, and it turned out to be a poem incorporated with the narrative. And we found that even though we wrote it and produced it, every time we listened to it, it would take on new meanings, just the way that these different lines would play together with the narrative and then with each other. So I think that was something surprising that we weren't even expecting.
Yeah, poetry has a, whether or not a poet is writing, I think, with intent, poetry itself just has a real fluidity of meaning. And then again, as soon as you take a poem and you remix elements together, once again, it's like you expand and you multiply, I think, the potential for meanings. But also because I feel like you left a lot of space, it was nice and open. There's plenty of room for the listeners to it's not so much impose their meaning, but just find themselves within the words or bring certain elements from their education to the content.
Excellent. Well, thank you for your words. And just a reminder to our listeners that tomorrow is the 27th Annual Women's Memorial March. That is starting at noon at Main and Hastings. We're posting the event info on our Unceded Airwaves Facebook and Twitter pages for you to find afterwards. But to end off the show, I wanted to invite Josh Gabert-Doyon to come on and talk about the segment that you've produced today.
Hey. Hey, Lisa. How are you?
Good.
Yeah, I'm Josh. I'm originally from Unceded Iroquois Territory. I'm a white settler. I do some reporting with the with the Indigenous Collective here.
And we're so thrilled to have you participate.
Thanks. This piece is from an interview I did back in November with Lena Menifee, who is the editor of Ricochet Media's Indigenous Reporting Fund. And she's also on the board of Ricochet Media, which is a really great independent media organization that's been around since 2014, and they've kind of emerged as a, you know, a real force. They're all online, and it's also bilingual, which is really cool. I spoke to Lena from her home in Minnesota. Now she's Gitxaqatl'a reporter and
Tsimshian territory.
Tsimshian, yeah, and she's like a really great reporter, and it was really awesome to be able to speak with her.
Excellent. So with that, I guess we'll just go into the segment.
Lena, thanks so much for talking to us today. Can you give a little introduction for yourself for listeners?
My name is Lena Menifee. I'm Yahahla, of Tikatla Nation. I'm Gisbidwada from the Killerwell Clan. I'm from the House of Wida Lee. I'm also a journalist and a digital strategist now here in Minneapolis.
Can you tell me how you got into journalism?
Yeah, I can tell you how I first got into journalism. I started actually with Red Wire magazine. It was a Native youth magazine that was in Vancouver at the time when I was going to the Indigenous filmmaking and documentary making program at Capilano. And I kind of joined up, and it was the best thing ever for me as a youth. I was kind of pressured into writing and using my voice when I was very shy about it and didn't think that anybody would want to hear my words or hear my voice or what I was about or my life experiences. So it was a really good place to get really good peer pressure to do so.
And from there, what was the path to Ricochet like? What kind of obstacles did you have to face in kind of carving out a journalism career?
Oh, that's a good question. So from Red Wire and then working, of course, on and off with the Indigenous Media Arts Group that did the Vancouver Indigenous Film Festival, there were a lot of barriers, I think, to going into reporting. And then there was also a lot of people supportive. So I was working with CBC Radio 3 on and off doing music reporting and doing videography for their really big shows. And that was great, but I was like, where's the Native music here? Where's the Indigenous music and the First Nations music and Métis music? And they weren't really interested in that. They said, we don't have that. That's not something we're doing. And this is so back in 2004. And then also, you know, doing a stint with CTV under First Story with two great mentors there before APTN started. So working on television and beginning to investigative reporting, I did a lot of research. And then I went back to documentaries and working on APTN TV shows, doing some of my own films, working with friends on that, and then moving back to my home territory to work with CBC Radio 1 in the north in Prince Rupert on Tsimshian territory, and having to do journalism there and constantly be told that nobody wants to hear, you know, infighting and First Nations people's stories, you know, that most people didn't get the cultural stuff there. There were a few good advocates, like Betsy Trumpner, who really advocated to make sure that there was always an Indigenous associate producer there or a producer now. I think there's been a few Aboriginal producers up there now. And having Alama Stewart, who's really kind of focused on getting more Aboriginal Indigenous voices heard. They're really helpful. But there was also people who didn't give a crap about Native stories at the CBC at that time either. So trying to have to sell them all the time, being like, no, it's an important story. People care about it. So this is way before CBC Aboriginal started. Mm-hmm. So there was, you know, there were tough times. Context was a big thing. They didn't like using residential school survivors. I have to fight every day to be like, you don't understand. Our people died in residential schools, just like people die with breast cancer. And so there's these survivors that are left. So they're technically survivors. And they wouldn't agree to that. They would say residential school attendees or students. Some fights on just being sovereign and understanding what sovereignty was with our stories. There was many fights using capital Indigenous, like people have capital C for Chinese and capital I for, you know, Indian or Indo-Canadian. They wouldn't use that for Indigenous terms. So, and all these things I think now are resolved in some of these big agencies and mainstream right now, especially with the CBC. So, you know, there's always a bit of tension with other people covering stories in our community, not really understanding how to, or the context, the history, or not really understanding Indigenous governance or comparatively to tribal traditional law, or understanding, you know, social determinants of health that affect our people where they are today. And I'd say at CBC, I was covering the missing and murdered women like in 2006, too, before people, you know, really thought it was a thing or cared to hear about it. Yeah, it's hard to be at the front and at the first of things. So we just kind of have to keep pushing. And that's why I really find my space in independent media a lot more. I don't have any restrictions. Nobody is really restrictive. And I get to give back and, like, try to work with other people who are emerging. or just trying to establish themselves as journalists who are Indigenous and youth or adults.
What other kind of resources does the Indigenous Reporting Fund provide? There's definitely the context, like you're talking about, and that knowledge. Is there kind of other ways that you're able to support journalists doing that kind of work?
I really think that the Indigenous Reporting Fund is a place where you can come if you're just an emerging person. Say you've never written an article before or column, or you've never spoken with your voice in an opinion editorial, you can come and we work with you in order to do that. So I've had a lot of people who've written their first pieces ever with us, and they're quite humbled by the experience. They get to show their solid professional work to their families. It's spread out in digital. So we've had these incredible young Indigenous Indigenous people and writers who just want to get their voice out there. And so we try to do that with them. So we take I take the time, other editors take the time to kind of work with them and polish their work, give them some feedback, and take them through the process, which is kind of intimidating to go through a process where you're taking your words and you're quite new and you're kind of spent a lot of time and you're very precious about your work, but realizing that you need to make it even better so people can see it. So the best work that you do will get out there. So, I kind of learned that process in Redwire working with youth. We didn't edit as much. And we didn't go through the process closely all the time. And we try to leave some people's artistic words untouched. But this is really about telling people about the process and getting them to their best.
You're featured in a recent Canada Land panel, and I think you spoke really well about the way that Canadian media covers corruption cases in Indigenous communities. And I wanted to ask you a bit more about that. What factors do you think have created the environment where corruption in Indigenous communities is widely like overreported or deemed more significant maybe than other Indigenous issues, especially, again, talking about mainstream media in Canada?
Yeah. The mainstream media loves a good corruption, Native corruption story or First Nations corruption story or Aboriginal, everything. Because it keeps in line with the narrative that they always know, that we're kind of third world people, we're kind of stuck in this poverty porn. Really, honestly, mainstream media puts us in love poverty porn, like all these people are so dire and there's such bad conditions for them and they don't see the positive things because they're not in our community seeing how we're surviving and thriving and our beautiful things about our culture. So I would say, like, the United States covers what I noticed when I first came down here, that it just covers, like, casino Indians, and it's always in a very biased tone that Canada always covers chiefs and sort of a corrupt tone, and they love it, and they can't get enough of it because it fits into the idea of, like, oh, they're still not colonized enough yet. You know, look how bad they are because they've done it to themselves. They have their own people taking advantage of them. Okay, well, it happens once in a while, for sure. I think the corruption rate, the last time I checked for the INAC, that was like 6-7%. But if you look at white leaders, Caucasian or non-Native leaders, the corruption rate can go up to 15%. That's in corporations, like big corporations, and that's the business realm. And then if you look at our premiers in BC, not one of our premiers has not been tried for doing something corrupt since the early 80s, I think, British Columbia. So where's the corruption rates for premiers and for mayors? And why don't they do more stories than that? And a lot of journalists in Canada are really afraid. They're afraid because they'll get, if they say something like that, and they'll get cut off their stories because they're kind of in the pockets of those people. So, yes, we should do some more, you know, stories on our own people, but why the heck aren't non-Native journalists doing stories on their own people being corrupt, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and that just fits into the narrative. Like, I feel bad about Native communities. I feel bad about First Nations communities. Well, it's their own government that's doing that to them, and they're not looking at the historical, they're not looking at colonialism, they're not looking at how we're stuck under the Indian Act, which is like South African apartheid, and it's still legal today. They're not looking at how every time we get a treaty signed or somebody gets an agreement that somebody totally goes and reneges on the whole thing or doesn't agree to it, or puts our people or our governance under the guise of Canadian government, and that we're owners to them, but they're not owners to the constituents. They're not looking at all this stuff, and so it fits nicely into that narrative, like, oh, their own people are just treating them badly, that's why they're like that. We have no responsibility towards that, and that attitude really has to change. It's reconciliation time now.
Thank you so much for speaking to me today, Lena. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Have a good day, Josh.
Boost your resume by studying abroad and get that dream job. Don't miss the Graduate School Fair at The Nest, UBC, on Wednesday, March 1st, or the Study and Go Abroad Fair on Thursday, March 2nd, at the Vancouver Convention Center. Admission is free. Come early to catch our feature seminar on scholarships. For more info, visit our website at www.studyandgoabroad.com.
Are You Aware Radio, alternate Thursdays 6 to 7 p.m. at CITR 101.9 FM. Profiling music and musicians take the route of positive action over apathy.
That was a segment by Josh Gebert-Doyon discussing the Ricochet Reporting Fund. You're listening to Unceded Airwaves on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Musqueam people.
Yeah, and so as we've mentioned, the 27th annual February 14th Women's Memorial March is happening tomorrow. So it's starting at noon at Main and Hastings. And we'll post the event info on our Unceded Airwaves Facebook and Twitter page.
That's an unceded event that we've been chatting about all episode, but just a reminder again, that's coming up tomorrow. Josh Kiyoki is going to be covering the Talking Stick Festival happening this week, starting on February 16th and going through until February 26th. So there are a number of shows coming up. There's a burlesque show of an Indigenous troupe reclaiming sexuality called Virago Nation, a hip-hop show called Standing Strong. Also, Moon Lodge is running through the festival, produced by Urban Inc. Productions. You can find a link to the event info on our Unceded Airwaves Facebook and Twitter pages, on Twitter under the hashtag Unceded Events, or at talkingstickfest.ca. That's it for our show today. It's 12:01. Thanks to Wendy Simon and Kevin Kakoska for joining us from the Native Education College. Thank you to Haley Lewis for contributing the segment with Myrna Kramer, and Josh Gebert-Doyon for contributing the segment with Lena Minifee. Thank you to Nikita Day for board opping for us, probably the most important job of the day, because without her, we would not be on the air. And Carly Baker for doing your first live interview so far on Unceded Airwaves.
First of many.
Really glad that that you took the initiative to invite them on, because that was such a cool event that I'm still so very upset that I missed. My name is Lisa Gerbov, and to end off the show, we have a song by Mariam called As Long As You Are Here from the album Bloom, and Mariam is coming to us from Cree descent. So this is a song to end off our show.
Defenseless.